On this week's 51%, meet a comedian turned mental health advocate.
I think the mental health care and reducing the stigma and increasing services would go a long way. That's my two cents.
A mother starts a social group for people on the autism spectrum. And storyteller Dr. Jerry Byrne shares her view on it's a boy or it's a girl. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
All I can do is keep breathing. All we can do is keep breathing now.
Jessica Holmes is a comedian and writer. She has opened for comedians like Jerry Seinfeld, Leslie Nielsen, and Ellen DeGeneres, and she performed with The Second City and Just for Laughs shows. She's probably best known for her work on the Royal Canadian Air Farce and The Holmes Show. Her first memoir, I Love Your Laugh, Finding the Light in My Screwball Life, was published in 2011. After battling postpartum depression and, quote, regular run-of-the-mill garden variety depression, Holmes began openly sharing her mental health story using humor. Recalling her frustration when NBDs or never been depressed would ask, well, why don't you just go out there and do something? Holmes points out that one of the most prevalent symptoms of depression is not feeling like doing anything, ever. It's an illness, she reminds us, saying, quote, I've never met someone with type 2 diabetes and thought, see, I've always just eaten bags of delicious sugar and been fine, so I'm not sure why you can't figure it out. Holmes spoke with 51%'s Elizabeth Hill about her new book, Depression the Comedy, A Tale of Perseverance. She says her work as a mental health advocate pushed her to intertwine comedy with a palatable conversation about depression.
I do a lot of public speaking, and I call it motivational comedy, where I mix mental health messages with comedy and silly impressions and stuff. And people were always coming up to me after the show. I could see in their eyes they had some pain, but they didn't even know where to begin. And they were kind of shy there in front of all these other people. And I felt like if I could just put my presentation into a book, so it's just a funny, easy to read, lighthearted introduction to depression, I felt like that could be helpful to them. And I'm really grateful to say it has been. I'm getting some nice feedback from it.
How did you become a mental health advocate? When did you start doing these presentations?
Probably 5 minutes after I recovered from depression, only because comedians, we say tragedy plus time equals comedy, or stress plus time equals comedy. And for me, depression plus time equals comedy. And when I finally got out of this horrible 2 years of feeling like I was trapped in cement, I just wanted to share my experience. And I wanted to say, oh my gosh, if I was in this for so long and I didn't even realize it, how many other people are kind of suffering but not speaking up or not seeking help for themselves. So I felt really moved right away to get to it. I started probably four and a half years ago.
Going back to comedians and depression, you have a really good chapter in your book, What Comes First, the Comedian or the Depression? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. There's a comedian named Mike McDonald, and his line was, there are two types of comedians, depressed and undiagnosed. And I had a chat with him for this chapter, and I just said, what is it? Are we just really sensitive, predisposed people who end up in this line of work? Or does the lifestyle of like being totally in demand and thousands of screaming fans, and then suddenly nobody calls you for 3 months? I was like, which one is it? And he and I both felt, and the consensus among comedians is that it's both. We have to be very sensitive people who are introspective to get into this line of work in the first place. And then, you know, it can be tricky to manage your ego, your hurt feelings. There have been a lot of high profile. Obviously, Robin Williams would have been, you know, the highest profile and comedian to go through that. But there are a number of people. Howie Mandel does a lot of work on behalf of mental health. The great thing is, though, now that we talk about it more, it's so much easier for people to identify what they're going through earlier and seek help. And then to know also that there's less stigma attached. You aren't necessarily, you know, going to end your career by saying, I think there's something wrong with me and I need help.
One of my favorite parts about your book is the character of Pat. Can you explain Pat and why you decided to write the book in that sort of conversational tone?
Sure. When I'm sitting at the computer and I'm writing, I'm genuinely having this loud, open, two-way conversation between me and an imaginary reader. And that just helps me write more off the cuff, more from my heart. So I ended up just including those conversations in the book where, for example, the marriage chapter, where I talk about how my husband was kind of oblivious to the fact that I had sunk so low. And suddenly the reader, Pat, jumps in and is like, whoa, 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 there was a husband this whole time? Like, how could you sink so low and nobody even notices? And I'm like, I agree. It's weird. It's a weird dynamic. It's a weird marriage. I don't know. So then I kind of examine it that way. And it ends up being also, you know, I never, ever make fun of depression because there's nothing funny there. It's a terrible, terrible illness. But I wanted to, in retrospect, joke about me missing telltale signs about, you know, my relationship with my husband, about this funny dynamic between me and the reader. And so those are the ways that I made it a bit of a comedic book without ever taking a jab at people suffering depression, because clearly I have been there and I know it. That's the farthest thing that I would want to accomplish.
And was there a reasoning behind dedicating your book to Pat, the reader?
You know, I thought the good mom would dedicate it to her children. But I truly just wrote this book. It was one day when a woman had come up to me from the audience after a show, and I knew she wanted to talk to me about her experience, and she was just crying, and she had to leave because she couldn't even get the words out. And so that was the person I thought, okay, that was the beginning of Pat and of me thinking, I really do want to reach that one person or any person out there who just wants a safe intro into us talking about depression that won't trigger anything further.
I'm curious to hear how you approached your treatment and what effects it did or didn't have on your family.
Yeah, okay, so first of all, I was really gung-ho to get treatment. I mean, it had been 2 years of me on the sofa. 6 months of it was the worst, where I truly, just between 9 and 5, I didn't want to get up at all. So that affected my family in that I was angry all the time. I mean, there's people suffer depression in all different ways, but my biggest telltale sign was that I was angry at myself and angry at the world because I couldn't snap out of it. I couldn't feel better. So my kids ended up making a scream chart where they would just give me an X anytime I would lose my temper. And I wasn't losing it at them. It's just like, if I spilled the milk, I would cry and yell about it for 20 minutes. Like, yeah. It doesn't make any sense. So when I did finally know what it was, I was kind of relieved because I felt like, oh my gosh, if I can get better, I can be like a normal mother. I can be a mother who doesn't cry when the milk spills. And I can be a normal wife who doesn't blame her husband's shoes at the front door for depression and stuff like that. So they have been incredibly supportive. And my daughter even recently did a project at school. She's 12 now. And she did a project on depression. So there's all kinds of compassion within the four walls of our home. And forgiving myself for that part was probably the toughest work that I had to do. But my therapist was of great help with that. The other part of your question was just about, you know, how did I end up getting out of it and out of the depression? And that was a mix of many different things. And I had to try them over and over and over for about 6 months before I saw any change. But those are things like exercise, learning to talk to yourself in a loving, kind way, not comparing yourself to other people, staying off social media, getting excited about a goal. There's, you know, the list is very long, and some things will work for people and some things won't. Yeah, I was really ready to get out of that depression.
And did you find any of that harder because you are in the public eye as a comedian and as an actress?
Well, I felt a bit embarrassed for the performances I had been doing when I was in the depression, because I could still suck it up for an hour a day or an hour a week if I knew, okay, I have to pay my mortgage, I have to do the show. But I was just doing tired old material, and in my heart I was so sad on stage, like on the verge of crying, but I would just put on a brave face and say, this is my greatest acting challenge ever. And I would, you know, just bull through it. And when I came out of the depression, I just decided, okay, I never want to be that kind of performer again, who's just showing up and reciting lines. I want to get on stage and genuinely share what I'm feeling and be more authentic. And so I feel like there's a lot at stake. There's a lot riding on my mental health. It's my career, it's my family. And more than anything, it's my own feeling of well-being. So I do everything every day. I take good care of myself like I was living the dream senior citizen lifestyle. Early to bed, lots of rest, healthy food. Yep.
Did you find that there was a different stigma for when you suffered postpartum depression versus when you went into this serious depression of 2 years?
Do you know what? You're the first person to ask that, but it is an excellent question, and I actually did feel a difference. I had suffered postpartum depression after my second child was born, but I got it treated, and I felt like, oh, that was just about the baby. That was just about, you know, that has nothing to do with me. It could have happened to anyone. But I felt more sort of shame with the run-of-the-mill garden variety depression I went through, because for that one, I felt like, oh my gosh, I think my head is broken. Like, and, you know, people hear about that and they don't just write it off as circumstantial. I could feel sometimes people thinking maybe I was lazy, or it was because I didn't take good care of myself, or it's because I'm a flaky person. And so I've had to fight against that stigma a lot more. And I still have friends who, they love me, but I'm pretty sure they think depression is kind of a made up thing, illness. So I've dedicated the rest of my career to mental health, and I can't think of anything more important to me to get the message out, especially having lived through it. I mean, I'm so grateful for opportunities like this where I can just come out and say, you know what, depression is very real. It's the same as any other physical illness, but it affects your mind, and it's nobody's fault. And we should take care of our mental health just like we were taking care of our oral hygiene. You know, you brush your teeth, you take care of your mental health.
We've discussed it throughout this interview. The stigma of mental health is changing, and it's better than it was, say, 10 years ago, even 5. But there are still many people who aren't comfortable dealing with or admitting to a mental health struggle publicly, as you've stated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What advice do you give them?
Well, first and foremost, I just want to say to managers and to companies, the biggest thing you can do for your employees is to let them know there won't be consequences to coming forward about your mental health, letting them know that you as a manager are someone that they can safely come to and talk to, and that they can help arrange for either a leave of absence or, you know, for you to take off work early the odd time to visit a doctor or take care of your needs without it permanently affecting your career. So that's something leadership can do. And then as for people themselves, I would just say your mental health is the most important thing in your life. It's your feelings. It's the basis for your sense of self-worth and wellness. So in my opinion, it even comes before your job. And there's a saying by Ian Levan's aunt, she's an author, and she said, "My cup runneth over. What's in it belongs to me, and what runneth over belongs to y'all." And I interpret that as you take care of yourself first, and once you're doing okay, then you can go out into the world and offer your services out there. But I hope people will take really good care of themselves. And there are small things you can do that only add about 5 minutes to your day, but that will help your mental health. And so I hope people will take a look at the book and learn a little bit about the changes that I've made, because I haven't overhauled my life. My life doesn't look that different on paper, but there are certain small things I do every day just to take care of me. And they're the difference between me slipping back into a depression and not. And you know what? I also just want people to know it's not your fault. I'm so sorry you're dealing with that, and it will get better. So please don't give up. Please keep going and know that every day is another chance to start over.
As a mental health advocate and as somebody who goes and does professional speaking on the topic, what are your thoughts on mental health and gun violence that we're seeing across the globe?
Yeah, that is really something tragic we're seeing in the news on a weekly basis right now. And I do feel that there has to be better access to mental health care. I think there has to be better screening. Like, for example, I went to see my doctor one day, and it was a GP, and I was there to get my thyroid checked. But I said, "Do you know what else I notice? I notice I feel angry a lot." And they just said, "Oh, well, that's not my department." But I sort of feel like, listen, why aren't all health professionals making sure to check in about our mental health, making sure to ask us things? I wish there was more free mental health service. I wish that more, particularly men, I wish more men would speak up about their mental health journeys to kind of give other men permission to do the same and to know that you can still be manly, you can still be strong, and also try and deal with emotional pain that you're suffering. I think the mental health care and reducing the stigma and increasing services would go a long way. That's my two cents.
Lastly, how has the healing continued for you through your comedy?
Mm-hmm. You know what? Every day, I just want to find an authentic way to be funny and to make it about mental health, to heal the audience. And that's why last year I decided I'm not a comedian. I'm a motivational comedian. I'm a comedian who wants to like help people through laughter and through healing. So I find it exciting to have that goal and to know that I can, you know, listen to an Oprah audiobook and then kind of find some material out of that so that you're making people feel good kind of on two fronts. But absolutely, there's so much work to be done in terms of making people aware, more aware about mental health and how easy some of the little things are that we can change in our day to help us have a better sense of well-being. And so if I can put that in between a joke or two, a little knock-knock joke here and there, then I will totally keep doing it.
That was 51%'s Elizabeth Hill speaking with comedian Jessica Holmes about her new book, Depression the Comedy, A Tale of Perseverance. There's an endless stream of advice online about how to make friends as an adult. While the lists and blog posts often mention that it's harder for 20-somethings to form meaningful friendships, and making friends can be even harder if you're on the autism spectrum and don't live in a major city. Side Effects Public Media's Isaiah Seibert reports on one group's effort to build those connections in rural America.
It's pretty quiet in downtown Henderson, a town in western Kentucky. A lot of daytime workers have left, and the streets and sidewalks are mostly clear. That means more room for Jesse Hopgood, Hannah Hall, and Rose Schreiner. Jesse studies a piece of paper he's holding, and the three are off and running.
I got flip-flops on!
Yeah, you got flip-flops on. That's why you can't run.
The paper has pictures of murals, building facades, things like that. All clues for a scavenger hunt.
It's right here. The six is like around here.
On this warm summer evening, they're competing with a couple other groups, and they're all part of a social group called Team G.
Together, experiencing autism meetup group.
That's Sonia Westerman. It's her brainchild. The group meets once a month just to hang out. They do things most young adults like to do, including bowling and pool parties. Sonia came up with the idea of a social group after watching her own son grow up.
He was going to church, he had his family, he had work group, but there was nothing out there social, and that's what he was really missing.
Social issues are one of the most common symptoms in people on the autism spectrum. They can have trouble developing friendships, even when they really want to, and it can often be hard to talk to people or express feelings. Hannah says that was a problem for her.
It's all you gotta do is just get people to join in and talk to them. Don't be shy, so you won't be afraid. Getting out in the world and stuff like this.
The website meetup.com lists hundreds of groups for adults with autism, but Sonia couldn't find any in her largely rural region of Kentucky. That's until she met Don Wheeler, the founder and director of Experiencing Autism Together. It's a support group for people with autism and their families.
Our younger people that were within the group were growing up, and then we had some older ones that wanted to join, but we have family events and there's a lot of younger kids at those events, and they wanted to mix with people their own age.
The Western Kentucky group started 2 years ago with just five people. Now it's grown to more than a dozen. Jesse was one of the first.
When I first started, I knew that this is something I have in common with everyone, and that this is I know this is something we can get to do together.
He had trouble making friends before he joined the group. Then, other than spending time with his parents, he didn't get out much.
This is putting us together as a big family, you know, and that's what it became.
Rose is one of the newer recruits. She joined after her 21st birthday, and she's still trying to develop friendships.
Yeah, I'm getting there. I'm getting closer. It's a lot of fun, and I really enjoy doing all these activities and just getting out of the house and being independent.
That's the point, Don says.
Last month, Sonia hosted a party at her house, and one of them, the comment was, we're being just like those that are our age. We're out on Friday night at a party.
Don and Sonia noticed that the group is getting closer. Members are more talkative, so dinners were added to monthly events, so everyone has more time to hang out. And they're anticipating more growth. Now, the group ranges in age from 21 to 36, but as others join, Sonia thinks it may split up, so everyone is closer in age. And she hopes they'll become lifelong friends.
And so ours may age up together in their 30s and 40s and 50s.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
The U.S. Department of Labor has announced the award of nearly $2.5 million in grant funding to organizations in 5 states to help women affected by the opioid crisis re-enter the workforce. The grants are called RESTORE grants. RESTORE stands for Reemployment, Support, and Training for the Opioid-Related Epidemic. RESTORE grants are intended to foster cooperative relationships among a wide range of entities. The department has awarded the 2019 RESTORE grants to Urban Workforce Advantage in northern New Jersey, where the grant will provide 100 women with occupational training and pre-apprenticeship opportunities. In New York, the University at Buffalo, Department of Family Medicine, and New York State Area Health Education Center will use the grant to provide soft skills development, resume writing, workshops, job readiness training, and more for about 200 women. Total Action Against Poverty in Roanoke Valley, Virginia, will use the grant to assist families by providing career services and job training to 120 women. And the grant awarded to the Helen Ross McNabb Center in East Tennessee will fund the center's Jail to Work Restore expansion project. And now, writer Dr. Jerry Burns weighs in on babies and gender.
When I had my baby, I tried to avoid gender stereotypes. I avoided dressing him in classic baby blue, though he got clothing gifts in that beautiful color, so it was hard to be 100% hardline about that. He had toys of all kinds to play with, gender-neutral stuff like stuffed critters and dress-up clothes. We had a pile of nondescript colored silks and fabrics that could be shaped into whatever outfit the imagination desired. But he also had that classic gendered repertoire of toys, only they weren't confined to people's ideas about what boys should play with. Yes, he had a wooden train set, but he also had a wooden kitchen stove, sink, and appliances. And that set of toys, quite frankly, took away much more of his attention. Zach had dolls and toy vehicles. He had things to build with, to make art with, things to climb on, and musical instruments to play. We offered him options without expectation or judgment, including the option to grow up and not get married, or if he did get married, to marry a man or a woman. It was a mouthful to say every time, but it was worth it. Yet with all our efforts, the world still gendered him. "Oh, look at your active little boy. How do you keep up?" Or, "So sweet and pretty, what's her name?" People often thought Zach was a girl, especially as he got into his toddler years with his long, curly hair. And I mean banana curls. Who could ever cut those off? Sometimes we'd smile and correct them when they were wrong, and sometimes we just didn't. It didn't matter to us what people thought, and it didn't matter to Zach when he was old enough to be aware of it. Mostly we just left it how people perceived him. His gender wasn't what made Zach Zach, and we hated to contribute to people's sense of mortification when they discovered that the little girl they were cooing over was actually a little boy. A focus on boyness or girlness happens because we live in a society which has traditionally felt strongly about the gender binary, that people are either male or female. Thus, we're hyper-aware of the gender of kids. But nowadays, our culture is waking up to the limitations of the gender binary, how it boxes in and marginalizes non-binary and agender folk. And yet, the gender binary is still a big focus for many of us, even those of us who want to let it go, like me. It's a focus because it's a long-standing habit and cultural tradition. I was driving down a road recently and something caught my eye. It was a balloon outside of someone's house, but not a party balloon flying from the mailbox flagging the location of a child's birthday gathering. What I saw was a single pink balloon with the words, and I'm sure you've guessed it by now, "It's a girl," boldly printed on it. This is an old-school tradition. I'm sure you've seen it. Gazing at it, I realized yet again how the world changes, how language changes, and yet the way we act doesn't always change to keep up. Old habits die hard. Is it really necessary to announce the birth of a baby with pink or blue balloons? Couldn't we just say, "The baby is here"? And then there's this. When people are pregnant, as a society, and I'm guilty of this too, we get all gender-focused and ask prospective parents, "Do you know what you're having?" Well, duh, they're having a baby. I give myself an internal kick when I ask that knee-jerk question. Or when a baby is born, when my first question is it a boy or a girl? There are more important questions, like, how's the baby doing? How's mom and dad? Is anyone sleeping? How is mom healing? Our cultural habit of locking children in gender boxes reinforces the gender binary as the be-all and end-all. But as many babies grow older, they won't connect to their biological gender assignment. There is so much more to a child than that. So I've been trying to train my brain to ask different questions, to take the spotlight off the gender binary. When someone is pregnant, I try not to ask about the baby's gender. Instead, I focus more on how it feels having the baby inside or inquire how active it is. I might ask if they're going to name the child for someone, then ask about the someone. My favorite thing to ask is about the foods the baby insists that mom eat. I mean, my baby turned me from a vegetarian to a ravenous red meat eater. Neighborhood cows ran for cover whenever I passed by while Zach was in utero. And when a baby is born, I try to focus my question on the whole baby, not its bottom half. Do you think the baby resembles family members? Tell me about that. Or tell me about their hair or its most prominent features. What's your baby cry like? A mew? A squeak? Something else? I realize this isn't perfect, and the baby's birth gender usually comes up in conversation anyway. But training my attention away from gender as the first and foremost issue reminds me that there is a whole baby with whole potential. I am trying to do with other babies as I did with my own, rejecting society's convenient categories and letting them be just who they are.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1577.